Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Dochas, hope. Growing up in the 1970s and 80s, every St. Patrick's Day was full of ritual. But those rituals changed with time. When I was very young, it was simple. You wear something green, you get your shamrock pinned on, you go to Mass, and to be fair, that last one was a lot of days. Okay, maybe you go to an Irish language Mass. Then as a teenager or student, celebrating your Irishness meant going out in a tear. And a few years later, you found yourself celebrating the patron saint at a concert or taking the kids to the All-Ireland Club Finals. Now, maybe it's a sign of age or nostalgia, and I'm not an ultra-real eater myself, but I feel that St. Patrick's Day isn't complete for me unless I get to sing the hymn Dochas Linn Niamh Padraig somewhere. We were taught it in primary school, and if you don't know it, it's a hymn to St. Patrick, Aspel Mórna Héireann, great apostle of Ireland. And of course, because of the way we were taught things in school, learn it by heart, repeat, 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 now, many years later, along with Kookaburra Sits by the Old Gum Tree and the Our Father in German, I still know every word. Dochas Linn Niamh Padraig, Aspel Mórna Héireann, literally, hope with us, St. Patrick, great apostle or advocate of Ireland. Anyam Oryark Glegal, Solus Mór an Téile, a bright and noble name, light of the world. I reread it recently, and it got me thinking about hope. Because when you look around you and you listen to the radio and you read the papers, hope can be hard to find. We're like little corks bobbing about on an ocean whose waves are being whipped up by forces on other shores. We almost haven't time to hope. Dochas Linn is a poem originally written back in the 8th century by a County Armagh man called Nanina Eckes. But the version we sing today is attributed to the Gaelic Revival poet and scholar Tomás O'Flanagan, who was born in Ballinrobe in County Mayo. And you wonder, what would Nanina Eckes have been hoping for in South Armagh in the 700s? Hoping that the flower of Christianity that Patrick planted would flourish, that the snakes wouldn't come back, or maybe that they wouldn't be attacked by hordes of rampaging Vikings anytime soon. I suppose we'll never know. But right throughout our history, our poets have taken time to offer hope. Patrick Kavanagh, in one of my favourite poems, The Long Garden, describes a wide-eyed, childish hope. It was the garden of the golden apples, and when the Carrick train went by, we knew that we could never die till something happened, like wishing for a fruit that never grew. Seamus Heaney was thinking more of political change when he wished, once in a lifetime, that hope and history would rhyme. Even Yeats, when he just gets up to go to Innisfree and look after his 9 bean rows, is hoping for a quiet, peaceful life. And Derek Mahon's relentless positivity would do you the power of good. The sun rises in spite of everything, and the far cities are beautiful and bright. I lie here in a riot of sunlight, watching the day break and the clouds flying. Everything is going to be all right. By nature, we're a hopeful people. Statistics show that in Irish, we use the word dochas 3 times more often than the word edochas, which is the opposite, hopelessness or despair. And even if God is less visible in our daily lives these days than in the 1970s, I think as songs go, Dochas Linn Niamh Padraig is fit for our times. In fact, if you were writing a song to sum up your country, say a new anthem, you could do worse than Dochas Linn. There's no marchons, marchons, wading knee-deep in the blood of your enemies like the Marseillaise. None of your long to reign over us like the next-door neighbours. You don't even have to pledge your lives to Ireland. Just Dochas Linn. Hope with us. That'll do for me.
I loved to learn. The early morning wake-up call on each school day did not disturb me. My daily destination, Skalcree Stree, a small school community in the heart of Clocklea in Ennis, its yellow walls warm and welcoming. The school student population spilled out from the main building into prefabs which formed a square enclosure. Many years later, I would return to the school as an adult to meet and greet the teachers that shaped many of my school day memories. I would find that the old building was no more. It had stretched and stretched till it could no more, and Skalcree Stree had been granted the luxury of a modern building. Back then and even now, Skalcree Stree was known for the extra effort its staff put in, especially when it came to developing their students even further. They did this by introducing their students to the world in a way that textbooks could not. This was the case in 2008, ahead of National Grandparent Day. I was in sixth class at the time, feeling grown at the idea of being the oldest in a school I'd been attending since I was small. The teachers had organized that some of the elderly people within the community would come in to talk to those of us with our grandparents in Ireland, a thoughtful gesture. If you've lived in Ennis long enough, you'll realize a few things. In this small town, things are kept simple and sweet. Locals have a sense of pride of place, and most people are obliging when it comes to giving their time to school students. As the saying goes, it takes a village to raise a child. Strangers to us at the time, these grandparents we knew nothing of would tell us stories of when they were young and what life was like. It's funny how generational differences melt away when it comes to storytelling. My adopted grandparent was a man named Paddy. What I remember most clearly about him is his calmness and curiosity. When he came in, questions would go back and forth like a ping pong ball. I talked to Paddy about my little sister, my brother who wasn't born yet, and we exchanged stories about our school days. He'd gone to Kilmahill Primary School and became a teacher in later life. He'd lived lots of places, Cork, Donegal, Tipperary, before coming back to Ennis, where he thought a Kilrush tech till retirement. I knew what it was like to move from place to place too, having moved from Lagos to Clare when I was small. Paddy and I found that we were surprisingly similar, both blessed with the gift of the gab, but equally interested in listening to each other. My own mom's mother passed away in Nigeria in 2011, but I would speak with my dad's mother over the phone now and then. She showered me with prayers, speaking Yoruba with a whipped, undiluted tongue, until I finally understood. I met her as an adult only 2 years ago on a trip back to Nigeria after a gap of over 10 years. As for my own grandfathers, I never met them. Both passed away before I was born. So the time I spent with Paddy, my adopted grandfather, was special to me, even if the moments shared were fleeting. November 2019. I'm sitting in the living room of my rented Dublin home reviewing my social notifications, and I notice a Facebook message from a few days ago. It's from Paddy's daughter. She was an SNA teacher and had worked in the school. She tells me that Paddy had passed away in 2011. Her reason for messaging me, though, is not to tell me that. She and her mother had recently come across a booklet that I had gifted Paddy on our last encounter. A distant memory of mine finds its way to the present. Like the image of a cinema film, my mind reeled back. As a way to thank our adopted grandparent, we had been tasked with making something for them. Confident in my molding skills, I had created a candle holder and made a booklet. I think others did the same. Miss Lynch had sent a picture of my booklet. I chuckled at my handwriting, big and bubble-like, with inconsistencies in how my letters curved, telltale signs of youth depicting the excitement of someone who had just started using a pen. My handwritten message read, "Dear Paddy, thank you for coming in and being my adopted grandparent and sharing all your wonderful stories. I really appreciate you coming in. Have a very Merry Christmas and have a great 2009. From Zainab." At the bottom of the booklet in printed font, it read, "This booklet was completed by grandparent Mr. and Mrs. Lynch and grandchild Zainab Olladale." All my memories of my time in the classroom exchanging stories with Paddy came flooding back. I'm amazed and touched that after all these years, this booklet still exists. The things we experience as children and the people we meet never truly leave us. They shape us into who we are as adults. No moment is too small to matter to young minds. Unknown to her, Paddy's daughter, Mrs. Lynch, had written the final chapter of my adopted grandparent's story. Thank you.
Protect you, trouble neglect you, and heaven expect you when it's time to go home. May you always have plenty.
In the 80s, I was famous, or perhaps more accurately, well known. I was a leading character in EastEnders, and for 3 whole years everywhere I went, people wanted to remind me of the fact. They would call me by my character's name, or ask after my on-screen flatmate, or tell me how much taller, thinner, uglier, or grumpier I seemed to be in real life. But when the 80s were gone, so, largely, was my TV fame. Occasionally a fan with a long memory would stop me in the street, usually as I was arguing with a girlfriend or picking my nose, and ask for an autograph. But generally I was forgotten, and I was happy. Except at airports. For some reason, at Heathrow, it was always 1987, and I was permanently treading the red carpet. Baggage handlers, security staff, the girls who worked in duty-free, even the stone-faced man who x-rayed your luggage, remembered me and were always happy to chat. So on one particular trip through Heathrow, although I hadn't appeared on TV for 2 or 3 years, I wasn't particularly surprised when the woman at the check-in counter saw me approach and called out, "Hello, stranger." I put my bag down and she went on, "Long time no see. What have you been up to?" I smiled quietly, mumbled something like, "Oh, you know, this and that," and tried desperately to remember what I had been doing since I was here last. "Keeping a low profile, I shouldn't wonder," she laughed, and pushed my boarding pass across the table. "Yeah, something like that." I stepped into the waiting area and for the moment, that seemed to be that. But it wasn't. I'd been sitting down for no more than 5 minutes when another member of the ground staff crouched at my side and asked discreetly, "Fancy an upgrade?" I didn't try to hide my delight. "Yes," I said. "That would be great." On the other side of the concourse, he opened an unmarked door, ushered me inside, and let it swing silently shut. We were in the first-class lounge. "Sit wherever you like," my new friend said, and then he pointed to a colleague far across the room. "Giles will come for you when the flight is ready." Now, can I get you a drink? And I took a drink, and a complimentary newspaper, and another drink, and then another drink, and then Giles came and invited me to go to the gate. And as I stepped onto the plane, I was greeted again like a long-lost relative and ushered into the first-class section. "Here he is," one stewardess said to a colleague. "We've been waiting for you." And she offered me a glass of complimentary champagne and a bowl of freshly cut fruit. And she took my bag and lifted it into the overhead locker. I was eating a vegetable biryani and looking forward to sampling the in-flight entertainment when she returned and settled conspiratorially into the seat beside mine. "Business or pleasure?" she began. "Sorry?" She looked around the plane. "Your trip to New York?" "Oh, yes." A non-committal approach seemed to have worked so far, so I decided to stick with it. "A bit of both, I suppose." "Tell me one thing." She was leaning close into me now, resting her hand on my sleeve. "When are you going to bring out another album?" I turned to look at her. Hard. "What?" "Well," she said, still smiling sweetly, "you haven't been on Top of the Pops in ages." "Oh, my God," I thought. "Haven't I?" And then I realised. I'm an imposter. I'm not in first class because I played one of their favourite soap characters. I'm not sipping complimentary champagne because I was a small but crucial part of their TV lives as they grew up in the 1980s. I'm sitting here because they think I'm someone else. Someone genuinely famous and talented and entitled to free champagne. The question was, who? Who did they think I was? And could I pretend to be him all the way to New York? "It's been a bit difficult lately," I ventured, trying to sound like I knew what I was talking about. "Of course," she replied, immediately sympathetic. "All this Britpop stuff." We were making progress. She didn't think I was in Blur or Pulp. But was I a solo performer or a member of a hit band? Getting the rest of them into the studio, I began trying to look casual and throwing my gaze upwards. "It's a bloody nightmare." "I can imagine." It seemed like I was on the right track. "There were a lot of you." "Were there?" I wondered. "Were there a lot of us?" So I wasn't in Wham or Bros, and probably not in Crosby, Stills and Nash either. And then she started very quietly to sing. And as she sang, the fog all cleared away. "Come on, Eileen, oh, I swear, well, he means..." They thought I was Kevin Rowland. They thought I was Kevin Rowland, the lead singer of Dexy's Midnight Runners. My first thought was, it could be worse. I was a fan of Dexy's. I'd seen them in concert. I'd bought several of their records. If it came to it, I thought I might actually be able to carry this off. She was still singing. "At this moment, you mean everything." "If I could write a few more like that," I said and tried to laugh. She joined in. "You'd probably own a plane like this," she looked around, "instead of just riding on one." I stretched my legs out and realised as I did so just how far away the seat in front really was. I took another sip of champagne. "Well," I said, "obviously, that's the plan."
March is the month of the Dublin daffodils. All over the suburbs of our capital city, in gardens, on grass verges, on roundabouts and on the central medians of our dual carriageways, there are great swathes of brave daffodils who seem to smile at us, regardless of the battering they might be getting from the wind and the rain. They do their level best to remain standing, nodding their heads and bringing a splash of sunny yellow to our increasingly grey urban environment. My father and my brother both died in March, different Marches and many years ago. My brother died very suddenly, and in the immediate aftermath of his death, my world went very dark. I found myself marooned behind a black wall of grief and shock. Everything had seemingly changed, and I felt as if nothing would ever be the same again. One morning, about a week after he died, on St. Patrick's Day 1996, I looked out my window, and for the first time I noticed a large clump of daffodils, standing together in their bright yellow clothes, that seemed almost irreverent to me in my deep mourning. What right had they to be so cheerful? But as I stared at them, willing them to show me some respect, something inside me changed. Because it was those daffodils on a piece of parkland outside my house that made me realise how important it was for me to hold on to hope. The hope that although all may ultimately be changed, all will be well in time. March is often the month when winter feels at its longest. We are regularly becalmed in the cold and the rain and the storms and sometimes even the snow, when we are longing to move forward into the sunnier, warmer, gentler, longer days of spring and summer. Sometimes we can almost smell those days, which we know should be waiting somewhere in the wings, but which tantalisingly remain beyond our grasp. But the daffodils, they know better. They are fearless about breaking through the hard, frosty ground in order to deliver their message year after year after year. Last Thursday, as I drove along the N11, listening to the radio and trying to come to terms with this new reality in which we all find ourselves right now, the bouncing daffodils once again caught my eye. They made me think that this too will pass. These days of uncertainty, when many of us are fearful about what the immediate future might hold, will pass. The Dublin daffodils stand together in groups to give each other their mutual support. They dare to wear their bright finery while we are still in the grip of cold winds. But their whisper remains as it ever was. They say that even when everything goes dark, we must hold on to hope. We must stand together and encourage each other. And we must never lose the belief that better days are ahead. So when it seems like we are all paralysed by the current crisis, and our lives have been forced into some kind of weird holding pattern, we need to see and to listen to the daffodils. They tell us that all is not as we might think. Beyond our awareness, this planet we call home is still turning, so that day still follows night, and in time it will also deliver our summer. And so, while we support each other through these uncharted waters, and while we do what we need to do to stay safe and well, we need to remember that this time will pass, and all will be well. The daffodils tell us so.
The crowd was back at Mass that Sunday morning after the winter landscape began to thaw. Snow had grounded the country for months and kept people from sighting one another, not to mention meeting. It was March 1963, the week of Cheltenham. Walking down the church steps, all the talk was of it. How's form? Will the ground soften? Will they race at all? How will winning fair do in the champion hurdle? He's a mudlark. Stick a few bob on him. For the women, On that return to Sunday Mass, there was a sudden show of hats. "Would you look at the plumage," my mother said, "parading themselves." While for the coal miners, shivering in the porch, there was the run to the pubs. Those miners whose other thirst was horses. Once it had been caring for underground pit ponies. Nowadays it was betting on steeplechasers. In the car, driving home through the slush, my father announced, "I'm going on the pilgrimage." "You're a great man for pilgrimages," my mother said. "Which one this time? Lourdes, Fatima, Loch Derg?" "I'm going to Cheltenham," he said. In our yard, after Sunday dinner, he gave me my jobs. I was to herd the cattle and search for the prodigal son, who'd strayed again. The prodigal son was the name my father had given to the thieving bullock. The prodigal son was blind in one eye. He looked sideways over ditches before jumping them. Our workman Andy had another name for him, the stag. "He'd win at Cheltenham," Andy said. So my father was off to Dublin Airport shouldering his binoculars. I was off in my Wellington boots shouldering a cattle stick, crossing all our fields, Ram Park, Deer Park, Hillocks, my boots sucked by the thawing pathways. A thin wind cut through gaps in briary hedges. There was no sign of the prodigal son. I'd have to break out into new territory, go down the hill, down into the valley, into the next parish. Won't my father be pleased with my efforts? I waded across the river. The water was still frozen to the edge of the bank. Then I felt thicker grass beneath my feet, a lusher feel. Primroses here. I climbed over a ditch and was on a wet road reflecting the shiny sky. A road I'd never stood on before. When I came across the line of parked cars and tractors, I was surprised. Small cars, Anglias, Austins, Scut trucks. Small tractors, blue Dexters and grey Fergusons. Then I saw the simple grey church in the paddock, plain glass windows with a gallery visible through them. And I understood the line of cars and tractors. In the gallery, they all suddenly stood up. With a slow pedalling sound, the organ started, and song pealed from the church, like it had no roof, and the trees stilled the wind, and the ivy rooted to the walls, and the cattle in the field lay down with sheep, and a pheasant lit up on a tree bough in the cornfield of the major, our landed gentry. And where was the prodigal son? He'd escaped from my mind. The hymns that rose weren't the least like in my own church. Nothing weak or stuttering or apologetic about them. And the last hymn, it did something to me. It was like I was being baptized at the river. 7 years later, I'd hear that hymn again. Easter Sunday, I was walking along Fifth Avenue, New York, Central Park alongside me. A group stood at the edge of the park. A striking black woman climbed a small hill. She sang and her voice swelled the air. "Who is that?" I asked. "She's Mahalia Jackson, the gospel singer," I was told. The hymn was the one I'd heard in the little church. It was called Amazing Grace. I think of those parishioners back in Slievarda, Tipperary. Some were men of the anthracite mines, descendants of miners who'd come from Yorkshire and who'd held on to their religion. Others were farmers, descendants of long-ago settlers. Passion was what bonded them, phalanxed them, sang them, saved them. Amazing grace. An hour of psalm and hymn and grace in a wee church in the middle of nowhere, out of time and worry and diversion. Our local hopeful, whose name was Winning Fair, he won Cheltenham's champion hurdle later that week. And believe it or not, he too was blind in one eye. And everybody said it was a miracle and had their shirts on him. And he was an outsider and the pubs were awash with money. And it was all gone in no time. I don't remember what happened to the prodigal son. I will remember my pilgrimage to the end of my days.
They're after locking down the old folks. The sign says COVID-19, restricted access, and I can't get in for my daily visit. I can't bring you carrot soup and gur cake. We can't have our cup of tea and a laugh. I can't help you into your nightie, brush out your hair, or put on your Pond's cold cream. I can't lay beside you, cuddle in and sing the old songs until you nod off to sleep. Ma, all I can do is send you word from the outside. The weather's gone mad. Even though the daffodils are out in Eden Moor, there's a howl of wind at night and hail showers by day. Your grandkids got drenched. And yes, the Brent geese have flown back, but Dollymount is lonely for them, looks bereft.
On this morning's programme, we heard Dochas Lynn by John Toll, Adopted Moments by Zainab Bolladale, An Upgrade by Chris McCallum, Dublin Daffodils by Barbara Scully, The Pilgrimage by Leo Cullen, and They're After Locking Down the Old Folks, a poem by Rachel Hegarty. The music was Dochas Lynn Naoimh Pádraig by the Palestrina Choir under the direction of Blanid Murphy. Never Alone by Sean Keane. Come On Eileen by Dexy's Midnight Runners. Springtime by I Draw Slow. And Amazing Grace, sung by Mahalia Jackson. And Zainab Bolladale's script, Adopted Moments, was recorded at last week's Miscellany Live at Ennis Book Club Festival. More from that event will feature on the programme in the coming weeks, including a full programme on the 29th of March. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy. To listen back to this morning's programme, see rte.ie/radio1/Sunday Miscellany.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.